Our next case for the morning is number 083275, United States versus Jesus Gonzalez Mendoza.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Larry Beaumont. I'm sort of pinch hitting for Kerry Ambrosio, who actually handled this case below and did the briefing.
Of the defendants do you have?
I have Mr. Villa.
Okay.
Our position is we believe that the court erred, committed clear error when he found that the defendant was a supervisor in this particular conspiracy and added two levels to his ultimate sentencing, and refused to apply the safety valve reduction, in essence based on the finding that he was a supervisor or organizer or leader. We believe that basically it seemed that the court, I reviewed the transcripts and the record, it seemed that the court played a lot of emphasis on the fact that the defendant, when he was arrested, apparently made a statement to the effect that he was here to oversee drugs and proceeds for a cartel in Mexico. And in addition to that, the court noted that there was some evidence that the defendant directed the co-defendant, who happened to be his brother-in-law, in placing some of the proceeds of drugs, $312,000, into a suitcase. It's our position that this overseeing business is nothing more than what all drug dealers do. All drug dealers oversee their drugs, oversee the proceeds, and basically did nothing more than that. And all this, the only evidence provided is the fact that somehow the defendant and the brother-in-law placed money into a suitcase. I mean, we don't know if the defendant just handed the brother-in-law a suitcase and said, let's put the money in there, or how it came about. The government cites in their brief a case called Martinez, in which they note that in that case the defendant coordinated shipments of narcotics, hired a driver, supervised loading of three trailers, and commanded another person to recover drugs and prepare for deliveries of narcotics. And the government note, or the court held, that these activities easily placed the defendant within the rubric of being a manager or supervisor. But I think by clear contrast in our case, we have none of those things. We have nothing to suspect that to show that he's hired drivers, supervised loading of trailers, commandeering other people. None of those things. And if you go through the steps that the courts hold that, or the guidelines suggest to determine if we have a supervisor, an organizer, or leader, which the government points out in their brief, decision-making authority. Well, there's no evidence to suggest he has any specific decision-making authority other than selling drugs. He recruits buyers, of course. So all drug dealers recruit buyers. The nature of participation in the commission of the offense, his nature and participation in this offense was selling drugs. I mean, he sold drugs to their informant. It was basically a one-time deal that they caught him in, and that's what led to the ultimate arrest. The recruitment of accomplices. There's no evidence necessarily to suggest that the defendant recruited his brother-in-law. I mean, I don't know that he did or he didn't, and it could have been just as his unwelcome brother-in-law moved in and helped in the business. I have no idea. But the bottom line, there's no evidence to suggest that the defendant at all recruited him.
The evidence was that Mendoza moved to Chicago from Mexico just a couple of months before his arrest. He didn't have a job. He was only 19 years old. He's living with the brother-in-law, your client.
Correct.
And helping out in the drug business. I mean, that's enough to infer that.
He moved in with my client. I mean, a lot of brother-in-laws move in with their brother-in-laws and show up there on the doorstep and maybe aren't necessarily welcome, but they're there. In this case,
The court was entitled to infer otherwise, right?
Well, I assume, yes.
Right, and that's all we need.
But the only evidence is that he's a 19-year-old kid living, in essence, with my client. I mean, that's the only evidence there.
Helping package drugs and currency.
Basically, I don't know how clear the court relied on the statement about putting the currency in a suitcase. So I don't know if the court relied specifically on this packaging drugs business, because the court doesn't cite that when he issued his reasons for finding that the defendant qualified for the enhancement. There's no evidence to suggest that my client got any larger share of the fruits of the crime or did any of the organizing or planning that was suggested in the other case.
Couldn't the district judge infer that your client had a lot of discretion. The cartel places him there and lets him decide who to sell to and prices to charge, things of that nature.
But the problem is, there's no evidence of what discretion he had. He sold drugs. I mean, again, I don't see the difference between any drug dealer, anything, with the actual evidence that's presented, what any and all drug dealers do. They find buyers, they sell drugs, they ship money back to whoever provided them with the drugs. And that's what in all conspiracy drug cases, that's the order of events. Seems to me that we would have needed in this particular case some other activity other than just merely putting the money in a suitcase with the brother-in-law. I mean, we would have needed some kind of coordinating, some kind of arranging with other people to help, some type of operation going on, which in this case there's simply no evidence of that. I think the court merely relied upon the statement by the defendant that he was here, and the court quotes him, that he was here to, quote, oversee, end quote, the drugs and their proceeds for a cartel in Mexico.
That's pretty good.
Well, it's good in a sense, but the problem is that's all what all drug dealers do. If he would have said, if there would have been some evidence of what overseeing meant and what my client specifically did in this case to constitute overseeing, perhaps. But it's void in this case. There's nothing in the record to suggest what that overseeing means.
Well, how about the amount of drugs and cash found in his apartment?
There
were
three
kilograms of heroin, 4 kilograms of cocaine, and $312,000 in cash.
There are a lot of drugs and cash found in his apartment, but
that signifies a pretty significant size operation that he's overseeing.
I don't know. That signifies that he's selling a lot of drugs. But does that mean he's overseeing any operation? I don't know. I mean, drug dealers may have a lot of drugs and cash in their apartments. It's probably usual.
He's not a street-level dealer.
He's
higher up the food chain, right? I mean, there's a lot of evidence here.
Well, the problem is, in this particular case, that's what he did. He did a street-level sale. He was approached by the foreman in the process of buying a truck, and the foreman said, oh, by the way, apparently, can you get me some drugs? And he said, sure. So he did a street-level sale. It wasn't like he directed somebody else to go out and meet the informant and do the sale. It wasn't like he said, well, I can get you the deal. You've got to meet so-and-so, and you can do your sale. He did it himself. So that fact in itself would suggest he's not any major player because he's doing the dangerous part. The dangerous part of the activity is actually doing the selling on the street, contact with other people. And he's doing that. So, I mean, it seems to me if he were a legitimate manager, leader, or some type of organizer, he would have somebody else recruited to do that part, and he could sit back and acquire the fruits of the crime. But in this case, he did it himself.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Gutierrez.
May it please the court. Counsel. This is an inconsistent judgment, an inconsistent decision to, on the one hand, apply the safety valve prerequisites, which is one of the prerequisites is that my client gave full, truthful, and complete debriefing prior to his sentencing. Interesting enough, the court found that he had been truthful. Yet on the other hand, there was an affidavit which questioned the timing of the arrest, which questioned how the arrest was conducted. Mr. Mendoza was instructed to submit an affidavit saying, well, you know, when were you read your Miranda rights? Mr. Mendoza said, well, I wasn't read my Miranda rights until I was taken back to the station. Timing. He was also asked if he was amenable to whether he was amenable to having to being questioned by law enforcement officers, and he said that he was placed in handcuffs while being questioned. So eventually he was handcuffed. There was no question about that. So once again, the affidavit that he raised was speaking of terms of timing. When was he handcuffed? Now, the court found that this was a material sequence of what it termed untruthful statements in the affidavit, and therefore a awarded him a two-point enhancement for obstruction of justice. And by definition, because he was awarded an obstruction of justice, he did not meet the prerequisite for the acceptance of responsibility, the 3 points of acceptance of responsibility. So it's a tension. On the one hand, the judge is crediting him with the safety valve, with being truthful. On the other hand, he's even saying, look, you're 19 years old. You came in from Mexico a couple weeks. You're a minor participant. So the court awards my client the 2 points for being a minor participant. And he awards him the 2 points for being truthful. Yet he finds the singular factor of his affidavit submitted regarding the actual timing of events. He didn't say that he didn't do this crime. He said under oath in his affidavit, I wasn't Mirandized until I returned to the station, and I was handcuffed right away when the police officers came in. Timing. There's no cases cited by the government to suggest that these two issues alone in an affidavit bearing upon the timing of the sequence, which we can all agree is in the after fog of an event such as this, could be just a matter of not understanding the sequence of events or not remembering clearly. Certainly my client didn't say anything that was material that subverted the investigation.
Well, it was certainly material to the suppression motion, and that's why it was...
Suppression motion, Judge. But it was material only in the sense that that he was submitting his belief as to the sequence of events.
Well, it's not just the sequence. He says that he was immediately placed in handcuffs and taken to the garage and not Mirandized.
Right, and the court believed otherwise.
Right.
So are we saying
that's certainly a material point on the issue of suppression.
It's a material point on the issue of suppression, Judge, but it's not material on the issue of guilt or innocence, and it's not material on the issues of the charges against him. So if we're saying that, first of all,
obstruction doesn't have to go just to the ultimate issues of guilt. It could be to the process along the way, such as the issues taken up in a suppression hearing. Whether this is voluntary or not is very material.
Well, Judge, it's material, but is it relevant? I mean, is it relevant?
This would have to be both, I suppose.
Right. I mean, is it relevant to say, could we ever say that a person who submits an affidavit saying that he wasn't Mirandized at this point, first of all, and the reason it's not material is because there were no statements that were trying to be excluded. I mean, if you're saying, well, I wasn't Mirandized really at this point, I was Mirandized later, I mean, that's going to the veracity of the testimony of the agents. It doesn't go to the veracity of whether we're trying to exclude a statement. I mean, what attorney would say, okay, we're gonna argue Miranda, yet there's no statements that I'm gonna try to suppress. The suppression was the arrest itself. And quite frankly, I didn't put the motion together, and I don't really understand it. So that's why I'm saying it was immaterial, because there was nothing seeking to be suppressed. What was being suppressed? Miranda is to suppress statements, pure and simple. And if he said, well, I wasn't Mirandized, well, what attorney would say, well, let's put a Miranda motion in if we're not trying to suppress a statement? What statements are we trying to suppress? So that's why I'm saying it's not material. I'm sorry. That's why I'm saying it's not relevant. Yes, it's material to the suppression issue, but it's clearly irrelevant because there's nothing trying to be suppressed as far as statements are concerned. And the handcuffing portion, whether he was handcuffed before he walked into the garage or after he walks into the garage, what was trying to be suppressed there? I don't get it. So that was the basis of my argument. Here you have a kid who has a 5-point swing in his sentencing structure, and there's really nothing they're suppressing. In fact, I think that this was moved to suppress as a piggyback to his brother-in-law. There are no statements that he's trying to suppress. Like I said, I think I've covered that. I mean, just basically, that's it. I don't have anything else.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you,
Mr. Bacciu.
Is the court, counsel. Maybe if I could start with Mr. Mendoza's appeal first, since that's, I guess, freshest in the mind. A couple of points of clarification from the record. First of all, the district court actually denied Mr. Mendoza safety valve relief. The district court found that, if you would refer perhaps to 8A and 9A of our appendix to our brief, there's a finding there by the district court that Mr. Mendoza was not entitled to safety valve relief. He had not met his burden of showing that he was truthful during his proffer. Slightly a collateral issue, but I thought I'd clarify the record. The other contention that's been made is that the idea is that the suppression motion wasn't really geared towards suppressing any statements. The suppression motion is document number 53 in the court's record, district court's record, and there's also a supplemental memorandum that was filed as document number 84. Document number 84 in the introduction, the first sentence under the introduction headline says, Gonzalez Mendoza seeks to quash his arrest and to suppress all inculpatory statements made after his seizure. And then it continues on a little bit later to say that Gonzalez Mendoza contends, however, that these statements were made prior to the giving of Miranda warnings and waiver. With respect to Mr. Mendoza, there were three statements given to by that defendant over a period of time. There was an initial statement given by Mr. Mendoza when he was first questioned inside the house. There was another statement given at sometime after 1:15 p.m. on that day after he had been Mirandized. And then finally, there were statements given after he was taken to the Berwyn Police Department later that night. So the motion clearly was directed towards trying to suppress the statements that had been made at the house via the contention that Mr. Mendoza had not actually been Mirandized whilst he was in the house. So I do think that the district court was correct in thinking that that was a material false statement that the defendant made, because clearly to the extent it was possible that statements made at the house were excluded, that certainly would impact the weight of the evidence the government had, particularly so with respect to the first statement that was made, because in that first statement that he made at the house when he was first questioned by Special Agent Vargas, he actually conceded that he knew that the money that he was packaging was derived from the sale of drugs, that it was drug proceeds. That admission was not repeated in his statement made thereafter at the Berwyn Police Department or at after 1:15 p.m. So it was clearly a material issue that would have affected some evidence coming in at trial. With respect to the acceptance argument, I've already indicated in our brief, I think that argument's been waived. The item we cite is from is on page 21 of our brief. Counsel clearly recognizes that if he's not going to prevail on the obstruction of justice issue, then there will be no acceptance. And that strikes me more of a knowing and intentional waiver of an argument for strategic reasons as opposed to a waiver of an argument based on an omission. And, in fact, counsel ably argued the minor role issue at sentencing and was able to convince the judge that his client was eligible for a minor role. So it certainly seems as a strategic measure that argument was not forwarded. With respect to Mr. Gonzalez Villa, I think the court's already highlighted some of the evidence. You know, a confession is like no other piece of evidence where a defendant says that I oversaw the operations of a drug cartel. That's an admission coming from the defendant's own mouth. It's probably the most powerful type of information that you can get. The weight of the amount of cocaine and heroin that was found at his house was also substantial. Two things, I guess, in response to the arguments made here today. The idea that this was just a street-level deal doesn't quite seem right, because he was talking about perhaps selling up to 3 kilograms of heroin. During the course of the recorded conversations that is referenced in our brief, he indicates that the going price for heroin is $65,000. So he's talking about brokering a deal which has a value of in excess of $250,000 with this individual. That's not your street-level typical deal. And the fact of the matter is not all drug dealers do what this defendant was doing. You may have a courier that has a specific, particularized role that doesn't require for the oversight of others. Here we have the defendant not only admitting that he oversaw others, but we have his co-defendant indicating that he received instruction from his brother-in-law. You have the relative age of the two individuals, and you also have this defendant brokering a deal with the confidential informant as well. So for those reasons, we'd ask that the judgments of the district court be affirmed. I'm happy to take any other questions that the panel may have.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. How much time? 1 minute. Okay. Anything further?
I just want to point out the exact quote that the court relied upon, at any rate, is the following. It comes from the transcript, page 16 of the transcript. The defendant admitted to law enforcement officers that he was sent to Chicago, to the Chicago area, to, quote, oversee, end quote, the drugs and their proceeds for a cartel. And, again, it's not, if he would say oversee the operations, the movement of the drugs, or something of that nature, I would agree. But in this case, it's simply to oversee the drugs and their proceeds. And that's simply what all drug dealers do. So what we'd be saying is that anytime a drug dealer oversees his own drugs and oversees proceeds, then he's some type of manager, or organizer, or leader. So I think what's lacking in this case clearly is all these other things that the government points out that clearly shows an organizer or leader, hiring drivers, loading trailers, commandeering other people to recover drugs and prepare for drug deliveries. All those things are lacking. So I think court error. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel and Mr. Beaumont, Mr. Gutierrez. You were both appointed for your clients, and you have the thanks of the court for your fine work on this appeal. Thank you. The case is taken under advisement.